acorns are dropping off my Chinese house. Two ducks in my spyglass, fiery as a mouse. It's a silly nature thing. It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing.
Welcome to Yarns at Yin Hu, a podcast about the fiber arts and other post-apocalyptic skills. Episode 81, Crushed Berries, Sunday, July 5th, 2015. I'm your host, Sarah, podcasting from the rehearsal space of Bovine Social Club here in beautiful, sunny, tranquil Delaware Water Gap, Pennsylvania. You can find me on social media as Sarah Pomegranate. The Yarns at Yin Hu podcast has a Facebook page, and it's available on iTunes. This week's episode features the following segments: the back porch, the front porch, off the grid, ever-expanding skill set, and off the shelf. Welcome to Tia and Kat from Minneapolis. Catherine is a knitter, and Tia is an adorable Jack Russell Terrier. And Catherine introduced herself on the Ravelry thread. Thank you also to Judy in the Dyes and Diane Laces for some very helpful suggestions and suggestions for additional resources on caring for linen garments. I decided to wash my Hane sweater in very, very hot water. It wasn't really a wash. It was more like a soak. And I let it dry flat. I used a steam iron to press out the ruffle that cascades over the left shoulder, and it does look like it's snapped back into shape. I haven't worn it again since soaking it, but I think that I'm going to be pleased with the results. Thank you both so much for your suggestions. It has been a busy few weeks with the end of school and a trip to Vermont, and the 4th of July holiday, but I've managed to complete some projects that I'm pretty excited about. I was participating in the Summer Surprise Challenge with Jenkins Wood Lovers. This involved purchasing a package of fiber from Nonoco. It was a 100-gram package, and though each package was somewhat similar, there were a lot of differences in color and texture. I opted for a textured package, which meant that I received quite a bit of silk noil in addition to the merino fiber and stellina. I'm not sure if it was stellina, but there was some sort of synthetic fiber content in there that made one of the bats very sparkly. Once receiving this package of fiber, we were to blend it to our liking, and we could use any methods we chose, and then spin it on a Jenkins drop spindle, and then we could ply it in any way we chose. So we could ply it on a spindle or ply it on a wheel. And I didn't realize until midway through the challenge that we were also divided into teams. And the people on my team had the same color package as I did, which was Summer Garden. I think it was 14 different pastel-like colors, and then a bat with a lot of purple, and then some blend-ins for the texture. I had a lot of fun thinking about how to blend this fiber. The colors were not my go-to color choice, but I set that aside and just really worked on experimenting. I'm pleased that I put all of the silk noil in just one section of the fiber instead of throughout. I think that makes it look very interesting, and it was a lot of fun to spin. I had all my singles completed before leaving for Vermont, and I wanted to ply on my wheel, which I wasn't taking with me, so I finished this spinning on the very last day of the challenge. I skeined it up to get my yardage, which was 353 yards, and before soaking it, I popped outside to take a photo. And just after I did, the skies opened up and it rained and rained and rained. So it took several days for the yarn to dry. Now it's very plump. The twist has evened out. It looks like a lot of fun. I think this would be a really nice skein of yarn to weave with. It would probably stand out nicely against a black or maybe a dark brown warp. And I look forward to working with it. I've also been doing a bit of knitting. I had a few visits from former students at the end of the school year, and these are students who are now finished with their bachelor's degrees. And both of them are going off on adventures that will take them well away from the tri-state area for the summer. And it was a lot of fun to talk to them and just to see how they've grown and their interests. And I said to each, send me your address and I will mail you something. So I bought some Cascade 220 yarn in a couple of different colors. And while I was in Vermont, I knit several barley hats. I love this hat pattern by Tin Can Knits. It's immensely adjustable because there's just such a range of sizes and it works up very quickly and I think it makes a great gift. So one of those will be going out tomorrow morning because I have received an address for one recipient and then the other will just be on standby and I think I'll knit up the rest of that yarn and maybe have some hats for donation or just hats that I can give at a later time. I also worked on an embroidery project while I was in Vermont. I have a cousin who was married on the 4th of July. My immediate family was not able to attend the wedding, but we certainly wish her well and thought that a handmade gift was in order. So this will be a collaborative gift, and I completed the first portion of the gift, which is a piece of embroidery. So I thought it would be fitting to have fireworks on the embroidery and also the names of the betrothed and the date of their wedding. It's the first time really designing something completely of my own. I was very happy to have Rebecca Rehnquist's instruction on the French knot because I used abundant French knots for texture on this. It's a relatively small piece of embroidery. Now it's in the hands of my sister Jessica, who will complete the next part of the project and then we'll get it shipped off to her. I'm competing in Stash Dash, the 5K portion of Stash Dash this summer, and it's so much fun to challenge yourself and also just to participate on the Ravelry thread and see the projects, especially the projects you see a lot because when you go to your portion of the thread, you have kind of neighbors on the thread and you can see their completed projects accumulating and then just the vast amount of yarn that's being knit into gorgeous projects and fiber that's being spun into gorgeous projects all summer. It just feels like you're really part of something and I enjoy Stash Dash very much. So I'm on the 5K completed thread and I'm number 42. I provided a link in show notes in case you're interested. And I have 2,962 yards to go by August 15th, I believe, is the deadline. I have a lot of plans, and I feel that I'm likely to be successful. Maybe next summer I'll go for the 10K. Who knows? The front porch. Tour de Fleece is here. The race began yesterday, and I'm participating with Jenkins Woodworking Lovers. There were several possible categories to participate in Tour de Fleece with the Jenkins group, and I chose Get Her Done, which is all about completing a project that you've already started, but you haven't made much headway. And I think you have to spin at least 2 ounces of that fiber during the time of the tour. So I will be spinning my gorgeous Hobbledehoy Batlings in the Folklore colorway. I think last time I said it was folk tales, but it's Folklore. Beautiful jewel tones, lots of sparkle. I will be splitting each batling in half and spinning each half on my little Jenkins Cuchulu and then plying those together. I think on my wheel, but maybe on a larger spindle. I might do some experimentation with plying this week. I also have Christmas knitting on the front porch. It's July. I have not begun my Christmas knitting. I have a number of other projects to complete before I start a lot of Christmas knitting, so could be crunch time this December. I'm working on a design project. It's going slow, and I hope to enter it into a competition. So I'm devoting a lot of time this coming week to completing that design project and also doing a sketch for it, which I have never done before. One of my goals this summer was to knit a really big shawl. I just want something luxurious that I can wrap around my shoulders in the summer months when it cools off in the evening or when I find myself in air conditioning. And Fernanda, my pen pal Fernanda, gave me some gorgeous royal purple yarn. It's kind of a sport weight, I think. It's 325 yards per skein, but I have 2 skeins. So I think this would make a beautiful big shawl. When I'm not thinking about the design project, I've been thinking about which pattern to knit with this beautiful yarn. And I have it narrowed down to 2 that really interest me. One is Blum by Melody of the Mandarines podcast. And the other is Pagoda by Dawn Catanzaro, which recently came out in Quince and Company's Shawl Week. I think both of these shawls are beautiful. And if you feel an affinity to one or the other, maybe you could nudge me on the comments for this episode, because as soon as I'm completed with this design project, I would like to cast on for that shawl, even if I knit it very, very slowly over the course of the summer while doing other things. And finally, I have some sewing on the front porch. I really want to get to a couple sewing days where I drop everything and just immerse myself in sewing projects. Being a beginner, I don't do very well sewing a little bit at a time. I can do that with knitting now, just pick up a project, knit for a couple of minutes, put it away, and that doesn't bother me. I feel like I latch into it, complete a good portion, and then put it down without a problem. Sewing is not like that for me yet, and so I really am looking for a day or two to just have the immersion experience. Finally, on the front porch is the Asymmetric Cal. It will not begin officially until August 1st, but some folks were lamenting that they were really excited to get started now. Get started now. Finish the project during the Asymmetric Cal, and it will all be fine. This Asymmetric Cal is an opportunity for you to knit, crochet, sew. I guess you could even weave and fashion a garment or accessory that is asymmetrical in design. It might feature asymmetrical use of color. It might have asymmetrical construction. There are lots of possibilities and many, many reasons why asymmetrical is the way to go. For one, it is flattering to the figure because it tends to draw your eye up and away because things are not placed on strict horizontal or vertical lines, which can stretch you out. And when the eye is carried quickly up and away, it gives you the illusion of a slimmer figure and kind of a more angular figure as well. So that's just one of the reasons to think about participating in the Asymmetrical, and I'll have more details as we get closer to August 1st. Off the grid. I spent a few days with my sister and her partner in mid-Vermont. They are living off the grid near Killington, Vermont. And I took this trip with my mom. We were helping Jessie with a lot of things in her garden while we were there. She was preparing delicious food for us. And I got to play with the dogs quite a bit, especially walking with the dogs. They have an Aussie and a black lab, who are polar opposites in terms of personality, but they're really good buddies, and they're a lot of fun to be around. Polka Dot Knits, in particular, was asking about Jessie and wintering over in Vermont. This was the second winter that the couple stayed through the snowy Vermont winter in their habitat. And it went very well. They learned a lot and they also tried some new things. So a lot of people worry about the cold. Jessie reports that the cold is the least of their worries. The house is very, very warm and very dry. They heat with wood and they've relocated their wood stove to the center of the house, so that the heat distribution is a lot more even. They also have some solar power now so that they can use electricity for a few different purposes. Over the winter, they did have some challenges with their solar power, and Jessie said that one thing she learned was to really approach things with a DIY attitude as much as possible. As far as the solar went, her feeling had been, well, we should probably get someone in here to look at it because people know a lot more about solar than we do and they can help us to fix it. And I guess they had a couple of folks in who were not really able to help them at all. And the expense for that consultation was high. And eventually, just by doing a great deal of reading and a little bit of research online at the library, they came up with a few possibilities and figured out what to do and fixed it. So what was happening was they had the solar panels up, but the batteries were not saving the solar energy. So even though they were getting abundant sunshine, they didn't have very much electricity. But things are worked out now and they're feeling very optimistic. Certainly plan on spending another winter. This year, they did a lot of maple sap collecting and sugared down their own maple syrup. I took a quart of it home, and it is absolutely delicious. And I thought I would also take the opportunity to talk a little bit about refrigeration in Vermont off the grid. I didn't get the opportunity to record a conversation with Jessie, but these are some collected facts and tidbits from the conversation we had over a couple of days. One of the challenges of living off the grid is food storage. So Jessie and her partner are growing the majority of their food and storing it over the winter. Now, some of that is frozen. Some of that is, you know, in the form of canned items. But there are a lot of things they just wanted to save and eat throughout the winter. And even more importantly, making sure they had food for the early spring. the growing season in Vermont starts pretty late, and most of their planting is done by planting seedlings that they've started inside. Then there's a very long wet season, and this year it extended almost until July, so it prevented them doing a lot of planting. And that can be the very leanest time on a farm, is when you're using a lot of energy planting and starting your new crops, but your store from the previous harvest is almost gone, or sometimes it's damaged or rotted by that point, and you have trouble really keeping things that you can still eat in the early to late spring. So refrigeration methods were key. In the cabin, there is a propane refrigerator freezer. From the outside, it looks like, you know, kind of a moderate sized unit, but the propane device takes up a lot of room in the fridge, so the capacity isn't as big as you might think. But that is very reliable. All of their dairy products and things like that are stored in that refrigerator. Then they also used three other methods for refrigeration and storage. They pulled 12 cabbages in the fall, left the roots on the cabbage, so they didn't slice at the base of the head of cabbage. They left the entire root on. They dug a hole in the ground near their house and buried the cabbages so that the roots extended up through the dirt. They buried them about a foot and a half deep, just in soil. And in the spring, they dug them out and they had 12 perfect heads of cabbage. So that is a method they might be doing again with some root vegetables. And just, you know, they were not accessible through the winter really, because they had about 3.5 feet of snow. But in the spring, they were able to get those out and then use them for their spring eating. They also have a storage space under the house, which is great for potatoes and carrots and things like that. It's accessible from inside the house, and it's rather small. So there's not a lot of air circulation in there. It's not great for things like apples. Those things are stored on their non-insulated mudroom, sort of enclosed porch area. They kept a thermometer outside in that area and tried to keep it consistently at 35 degrees. By opening the interior door if it got too cold out there, and opening the exterior door if it got too warm. And in doing that, they were able to keep that at a fairly consistent 35 degrees Fahrenheit. And that was storage for their apples, a lot of squash. They had a lot of different things out there. As early as possible, they planted kale and collard greens in one of their greenhouses, and that has been their fresh green veg, in addition to potatoes and root vegetables, things like that, throughout the spring. So they're very excited for the new growing season and having some fresh things on hand in July and August. Another aspect of refrigeration that we discussed was what not to refrigerate. When your refrigeration capacity is low, you really do need to think about what is absolutely essential and what doesn't need to be refrigerated. Sometimes people get, you know, a little bit uncomfortable, and certainly if you have a delicate system for people who are unwell, older, and probably for the very young, it's not a good idea to take risks with refrigeration, but there are some things that it's really okay to leave them out. In the cooler months, it's okay to leave butter out. It's always available to spread, and it's not hard as a rock in your refrigerator. Jesse also leaves cooked rice and grains that are left over sitting in a pot right on her stove. And overnight, things like that do not spoil. She uses a lot of tins to store bread, to store baked goods, and they just keep things fresh and airtight without the need for refrigeration. In addition to the gardening that we did while we were visiting Vermont, we also tried our hand at some natural dyeing. In the fall, Jesse collected elderberries by foraging in the woods nearby, and she froze two giant bags of elderberries. We took one of them, made a dye bath. I did mordant work on the yarn and fiber that I had brought with me by using alum and cream of tartar and preparing that fiber to accept the dye. We also tried a dye bath made from avocado seeds and skins, and all of this dyeing was done over an open fire. The dye bath colors were extraordinary, but the dye, even with simmering for an hour and then soaking overnight, the dye seemed to sort of run right out of the fiber and yarn rather than hold that vibrant color that was in the dye pot. And in reading up on natural dyeing, it's certainly clear to me that natural dyes are inconsistent at best and that you can get a really wide range of color. Also, we were using frozen berries as opposed to fresh, and that can affect the color. We did not use any fixatives or additives after the dye process. We just let the yarn and fiber dry, and then we gave it a soak to rinse out any leftover dye materials and then let it dry again. I've posted a photograph of some of the yarn that I dyed, and it is beautiful. It's really lovely, soft color, but it's not as vibrant, certainly, as the dye bath made it seem. I've read that you can continue to get a more vibrant dye with avocado seeds and skins by continuing to bring them to a boil and then let them cool. You can intensify the color, and also by adding washing soda. So I'm thinking about making some of my own washing soda, as simple as taking some baking soda and baking it, I think, for 15 minutes at 400 degrees, and then you have washing soda. And you add just a teeny tiny little bit of that to the dye bath, and you can change the color of the dye. So this dyeing process will continue throughout the summer. I'm also continuing to work on some rust dyeing. Right now I'm out of fabric, so I need to go to the store and pick up some more 100% cotton fabric. I might try something at a more delicate weight of fabric this time when I shop, and continue working with that. Ever-expanding skill set. Preparations are underway for the tasting menu that Samuel and I will be preparing for 40 people at Sarah Street Grill. The date is July 14th. And all of these dishes will be paired with wine by the gentleman who's in charge of the wine program at Sarah Street Grill. We are doing a Nashville-inspired small plates menu. So my kitchen has turned into a test kitchen, and that is much more agreeable with the addition of a new stove and hood. The hood for the stove in the kitchen has never worked since the time we purchased the house, and the stove was down to three burners. I'm pretty sure the stove was older than I am. So it was time. We took a long time deciding about what we wanted, and the new stove has arrived. The hood is hooked up so that it pulls steam off of boiling pots of water and so forth. And it's really a lot more pleasant experience working in the kitchen. This has inspired a week-long kitchen spruce-up endeavor. So this coming week, Samuel and I will be removing everything from our kitchen, sorting through it, touching some things up and making some small improvements. This is not a kitchen renovation by any means, but I think it will result in overall improved function and maybe some added features that will make cooking a little easier and tidier, things like that. One of the additions that could take a while is that we plan to install a slide-out pantry set of shelves that are, they're on a track and they pull well into the room and then store away in a very narrow cupboard. I've seen a few of these installed online and it seems like an ideal solution for our very small space. This involves getting some specialty hardware and also figuring out how to install the hardware. So that might take a little bit longer than a week, but it's definitely on our list of ways to optimize the kitchen. I'm really excited to take everything out, to sort through it, to give away or get rid of things that we're really not using and pare everything down, and to just rethink the space in general, where we're storing certain things and how we use the space. I thought that July would be a good month to think about countertops and counter space for hashtag Power Pantry, our year-long endeavor to improve the effectiveness of our pantries and our kitchens. And I'm wondering about your countertop. First of all, what is it made of? Do you have a variety of different materials? Are you putting up with what you have, or have you made some selections that you're really happy with? And what do you keep on your countertop? My line of thinking is there is never, ever, ever enough counter space. But having the counter space stuffed with appliances is certainly one way to take a lot of it up before you even get a chance to work on it. So do you have tips? Do you have suggestions? Do you have habits or strategies that work really well for your counter space? I'd love to see a photograph of your counter space. There's a thread open on Ravelry, and I look forward to your participation there. Are you reading along with other Yarns at Yin Hu listeners? The book selection for our summer read-along, extending until September 1, is Color, A Natural History of the Palate by Victoria Finlay. I have posted a reading schedule on the blog and on Ravelry. This is not intended to restrict your reading in any way. It's just a good gauge for me to read and also talk about my reading on the podcast. Since this is a nonfiction book with no spoilers or anything like that, I invite you to share anything at all about the text that you're enjoying or connections you're making as you're reading. And I look forward to learning about your insights and your perspective on this work. Victoria Finlay seems to be setting about this exploration of color in the metaphor of a journey. There's an introduction in which she talks about the paint box, and the way she's exploring color does have more to do with paints and pigments than it seems to do with dyes, at least in the early part of the book. But I think there are a lot of connections for textiles and dyeing, and it's not all about painting and other kinds of artwork. The first chapter is about ochre, and it takes her to Australia. I found her descriptions of the landscape and the people to be very illuminating, and it's clear how her investigation about this color or range of colors that are available in Central Australia has progressed. One of the things I've been thinking about is a connection between this reading and some of the work of Rudolf Steiner that we've been studying at Fibercraft Studio in my Sheep to Shawl class. Rudolf Steiner originated the Waldorf School of Education, and he had a lot of ideas about young people and how they should be educated in order to be productive, forward-thinking citizens. One of the things he lamented was a fascination with extremely bright, even garish, or sometimes I think he referred to them as violent, uses of color in the lives of children. And his school of thought is that children should be exposed to soft, natural colors, because if they're overexposed to saturated colors, it will dull their sensitivity. And certainly the colors that I've been able to achieve with natural dyeing do not have the vibrancy of commercial dyes that are available. So on the one hand, I'm learning, I think, to appreciate subtlety of color and not see it as a defect. And on the other hand, I can also appreciate what must have been the overwhelming joy of people, especially in textile industry, to have, you know, ready-made commercial dyes that would give you a pure and consistent color that you could count on every time. You know, now we take those kinds of things for granted, but when those dyes emerged, it must have been very exciting to be able to get a true dye color and to know what to expect when you were using it on fabrics. Here's a passage from page 67 in the Ochre chapter. Whenever a friend was asked what his favorite color was, he would say that it was just that, the red of the Australian center when you flew over it in the morning. From this bird's eye perspective, the spinifex and other bushes made little dots on the landscape, just like so many of the central desert paintings I had seen. And from a plain, the dried-up creeks and the curves of rocks turned into whirls and wiggles that no doubt had whole epic choral symphonies enclosed in them. I've posted two photographs, one which is an aerial perspective of Central Australia with, I assume it's spinifex, I'm not sure, but it's little bushes, little dry bushes that dot the landscape and cast their shadows. And then I've posted a photograph of a painting by Rover Thompson that's discussed in the Ochre chapter called All That Big Rain Coming Down. And by looking at some images online, I was able to grasp even more the connections that Victoria Finlay was drawing between the landscape from above and the use of these pointillist style dots that create the abstract images of these central desert paintings. There are a few plates in the center of this paperback book. I have the paperback version, but I feel like further investigation and doing some image searches on Google has definitely helped me understand some of the content she's discussing in the chapters a bit more. So as I am curious, I will continue to find and to post some images to our discussion and then also on the Yarns at Yinhu blog as I read. I look forward to your perspectives and input on the reading of color. You can join in this read-along anytime, and hopefully this will fuel your own exploration of color in your life this summer.
Acorns are dropping off my Jenny's house. Two ducks in my spyglass, flowery as a mouse. It's a silly nature thing. It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. Leaves her down like a lady, waiting for a naked man. River bends like an elbow, turning stones to sand. It's a silly nature thing. It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. Sycamore trees are blazing like a rainbow fire. Just like Linda Curtis, but out on a wire. It's a silly nature thing. It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing.
Thanks for listening. Music in today's episode is Sweet. Music and lyrics by Samuel St. Thomas, performed by Chris DeLong and Cesar Diaz. If you enjoyed today's episode, I hope you will consider leaving a star rating or a review on iTunes, liking the show's Facebook page, or joining the Yarns at Yin Hu group on Ravelry. Eat well and stay strong as you hone your post-apocalyptic skill set this week.
It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing.